News.
New York City.
The FAQ NYC podcast getting more and more interesting by the minute.
FAQ.
It's FAQ NYC, the New Yorkist podcast. I'm Katie Honan here with Harry Siegel, and in just a minute, we'll welcome Andrew Rhine from the Citizens Budget Commission to dig into the state's newly passed, weeks-late budget and what New Yorkers can look forward to as the council and the mayor head into their own negotiations for the coming city budget. But before that, here's Harry Siegel with just some of the news from an extra jam-packed week in New York City.
Hey, Katie. Mayor Eric Adams this weekend blamed, quote, professional agitators seeking to seize the ongoing conflict in the Middle East to sow chaos and division in our city for the ongoing protests at Columbia University involving students inside the gates and often other people outside, saying he was, quote, horrified and disgusted with the anti-Semitism being spewed at and around the Columbia University campus. That came days after the NYPD entered the campus at the university's request and arrested more than 100 people, mostly students, from what they are calling a Gaza solidarity encampment on campus. While President Manoush Shafiq said all the students who have been part of the encampment have been suspended and thus have been trespassing, organizers there and on other campuses have continued and started a new encampment since that move, which came just after Shafiq testified before the House Committee on Anti-Semitism and vowed to take a tougher approach. Just before we record on Monday morning, Shafiq said all classes Monday would be online. And the latest sign that what you hope would be an endgame move isn't playing out that way. And notably, I guess, with Passover beginning on Monday evening. That's hours after opening arguments begin today in the Manhattan trial of Donald Trump. So this weekend also saw the latest performance of the Inner Circle show, the local version, I guess, of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, in some sense, where the city's political class convenes to be musically mocked by its journalists. So midway through the rundown, I've never been to one of these shows, but Katie and Andrew, you've been there. You were there last night performing, Katie. Can you share what they're like and what's in it for the press and pals in this reversal of sorts from the usual thing where the officials are on stage and, the ink-stained wretches are scribbling notes and trying to get questions answered?
Thank you, Harry, for interrupting our news break to talk about our little show in its 101st performance. It was great. I actually, this is my second year performing, and this year I joined the writing committee. I played a bag of trash and myself, two different costumes. So I was told by many of the longtime members that it is very rare to play yourself in the Inner Circle, so I felt honored. We closed Act One with a Guys and Dolls sit-down parody where we parodied Menasha Shapiro stealing chairs from the rotunda. I love it. I never performed in theater. I went to a financially distressed high school, so we didn't have any shows or theater budget. I like to sing karaoke, but that's about it. But I had a great time, and I think the audience seemed to like it. I think we were pretty brutal in some of the songs on Mayor Adams. Dancing Queen became campaign scheme. You know, we opened the act with Staying Alive. You can tell by the way I use my walk, I'm in trouble, man, which I think sums up a lot of turkey jokes. The show was called Turks and Chaos. So yeah, I mean, Andrew, you don't have to, not to put you on the spot, but did you enjoy the show? You came Friday night, which is the dress rehearsal night. Saturday is when all the muckety mucks come.
I won't take any insult on the whole muckety muck aside.
No, it's good that you're not a muckety muck.
The reality is Friday is the dress rehearsal. It is one of the most fun evenings of the year. CBC staff come, we picnic, you bring your own food and beer, and you watch the press corps do what they do second best, which is display their incredible talents, singing, dancing, and the writing is always amazing. I will say, Harry, you said that it was kind of local version of the White House Correspondents. I always thought the White House Correspondents version was the national version of the more important Inner Circle.
Thank you.
Of course, LCA show, I want to give a shout out because that comes up too. The talents are amazing. The writing's amazing. Almost as amazing as what we read in the papers every day.
Yeah. And no, when you have a mayor like Eric Adams, who we'll get back to in a second, truth is actually better than fiction a lot of the time.
And the cameos, the attorney general, she's always awesome. She is great. The personalities come through. And when mayors come and make fun of themselves, whether it's Mayor Adams this year or going back to when Mayor Giuliani was in a dress, all that kind of stuff is good.
Yeah.
So Speaking of Mayor Adams,
I know this is a good transition.
Cracked a joke about the New York Post. He said a terrifying talk about crime rate in New York. Hey, that's my job. What up, Rimshot. A new poll, back to the news roundup, from the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank, found that just 16% of likely voters would back him if the mayoral election was held today. 73% disapproved of the job he's doing. With just 7 months to the presidential election, and then just 8 months after that to the city's primary, his numbers are not much better with Democrats. He's getting short on time to turn those numbers around. Meantime, NYPD section, advocates said they were, quote, horrified by the egregious abuse of power by top NYPD officials with close ties to the mayor, who were accused in a new lawsuit of weaponizing the sexual assault report of a prominent police reform advocate to smear her. Separately, a second suit was filed by a second police officer against a top Adams aide and former NYPD colleague, Tim Pearson. The former, he was an inspector in the NYPD. He's now accused while working for Adams at the EDC of harassing a female sergeant out of the department, and taxpayers are covering his defense bill, with Adams suggesting at one point that was warranted because Pearson had been a first responder after 9/11. Another ex-cop, Bo Deedle, was dropped by the mayor's legal defense fund after telling a reporter who'd asked what work the fund was paying him to do to, quote, go suck dick somewhere, unquote. The defense fund has raised $1.2 million so far from donors and spent nearly $750,000 to date on legal bills, as two separate federal investigations appear to be investigating ties between Adams' campaigns and the governments of Turkey and China. And another person pleaded guilty in a scheme also involving a different retired NYPD inspector and old friend of Adams, who had already pleaded guilty, to funneling straw donations to Adams' 2021 mayoral campaign in the hopes of scoring contracts from his administration. So that brings us back to governance, Katie.
Back to governance. And it'll bring us to our guests. So City Hall is claiming it won on every single item on the mayor's Albany agenda in the nearly $250 billion state budget finalized this weekend. It includes a new tax break to get housing built, new tenant protections, some new state money to cover the costs of migrants arriving in the city, a short-term extension of mayoral control of the schools, new tools to let the city padlock unlicensed pot shops, letting New York City further reduce its speed limits, and even a new commission to cover the waterfront. Joining us now to break that down is Andrew from the CBC. Andrew, we just heard you speak about something a little less consequential, the Inner Circle, but I want to thank you so much for coming. And, you know, if you want to talk a little bit about the state legislator and Governor Hochul's agreement on this $237 billion budget, that's $4 billion more from what she presented earlier this year. What's your initial take on it and maybe some of the stuff that hasn't really hit the headlines?
Well, thank you very much for having me. I mean, what's interesting here is the numbers you mentioned, $237 billion and $4 billion more, are the only two budget numbers talked about. Here we have a state legislature and a governor agreeing to a budget of spending the people's money, yet what everyone would picture as a budget, which is a table, what revenues you come in, what, you know, spending goes out, what does the bottom line look like in the current year and then in the future? The state, it is outrageous that the state passes what it calls a budget without producing a basic set of financial plan tables to know what is happening. So that's the first thing to notice is, once again, it's Albany business as usual, no change, but Albany business as usual is not a complimentary term. The reality is we still don't have financial plan tables. If passed as prologue, we won't have them for four more weeks. And of course, this is 3 weeks late. And it's not late because we had a hack and eclipse and the day after Easter. It is their job to produce a budget, and they haven't done that. But what I will say, what we can surmise from the limited information we have on the fiscal side, is there's plenty of money to go around this year. But what they've done is built the house of cards bigger and bigger and bigger to create what is likely a more than $16 billion structural budget gap just a few years in the future. But that's because spending's growing, even after it had grown 26% in the last 3 years. So spending grows. Revenues will grow, you know, fairly robustly and maybe even a little more than they say, but it's built on a house of cards because those trends diverge. More spending than revenue growth, plus we have temporary tax increases that'll go away. We had an economy during the pandemic, although bad for some, generated a lot of revenue that they spread over time. So we've built this house of cards. So again, the losers today are New Yorkers who don't know really what's in the budget fiscally, and the losers tomorrow will be those who, when there's a state fiscal reckoning and the house of cards come tumbling down, it's usually the neediest New Yorkers who get hurt.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and you've been saying that about the city budget as well, we're sort of kicking the can down the road. I just quickly wanted to ask you if you can briefly talk about the changes to this less generous pension tier, that's how Politico put it, and what it can cost taxpayers. I know an independent, there was an analysis by you all that said it would be an additional $400 million annually. So what does that mean for New Yorkers, a sort of pension tier?
So tier six, which was enacted 13 years ago because the pensions are growing and growing and they're a big burden on state and local governments. Tier six was less generous than the previous tiers. However, if you're a job seeker in the marketplace, tier six is a defined benefit plan, which is a fancy term for meaning you and the state puts in money and you know what you're going to get when you retire. Defined benefit plan, you know what you're going to get. It's not the vagaries of investments or the markets. That is an incredibly solid, stable retirement, much better than you're looking at in the private sector. Now, listen, state and local governments are having trouble recruiting. So the union said, hold on, we want to enhance tier six benefits so that it'll help recruiting. Actually, what it'll help is their members get more benefits. And I understand that that's their job and that makes some sense. The reality is it was unnecessary because it is not the problem with recruiting. It's already more generous. It's unaffordable because over the lifetime, it'll cost $4 billion for state and local governments. And next year, it will be almost $370 million just this current next year for state and local governments. And it's also an unfunded mandate, unnecessary, unaffordable, and unfunded mandate on local governments, including New York City, who's going to have over $250 million of bills just because Albany, who doesn't pay those bills, passed legislation to force New York City and all the other localities and school districts to pay. Now, I understand, you know, pension benefits, retirement is hard. I'm getting closer there myself. But the reality is, from a public sector point of view, we need to be competitive, but we also need to balance our bills. And this is an unfunded, unnecessary, unaffordable mandate.
So, you know, looking ahead to what you predict, this house of cards collapsing, what are Hochul and the state legislator not doing that they should be doing to at least protect the state and its finances in the next year, two, three, 10 years?
The reality is, if we use the largesse, remember, we got all this federal aid in COVID, we raised temporary taxes, and frankly, we didn't need to raise those because look at all the money that's flowing, and mostly from the financial services industry. If we use that as a bridge to a stabilized, you know, future, we could do that. What that means is you make some hard choices, you figure out what works in government, you fund that. You figure out what doesn't work as well, you fund that. So you have to restrain spending and you have to manage better. So the governor proposed, for example, a very common sense change to the school aid formula, getting rid of the hold harmless. There's a whole formula, you put all the factors in. And if a school district's enrollment goes down, frankly, if you're serving 900 kids, you used to serve 1,000, you need fewer teachers, you need less money. But there's this hold harmless that says your money never goes down, even if your enrollment goes down. The governor was exactly right. Common sense, but of course the legislature rejected it. That's part of this unaffordable, unnecessary spending that we keep building up. If we restrain spending and we get closer to inflation, we can start to really shrink that structural gap, let those taxes go away, but we have to make hard, smart choices just a little bit every year. The problem is when there's money in the pot, burning a hole in the pocket, drunken sailors will be jealous. We like to spend. The governor proposed, I mean, and this is, you know, if you flew in from outer space, you would listen to the discussion. You would think that we're this austere place that doesn't spend money at all. We have increased spending 26% over the last 3 years. The governor proposed a $4.8 billion increase in state-funded spending, state operation spending, yet the legislature has just reversed some of those spending controls and added more spending. So we'll see when we finally get the numbers how much it is. We just have to do a little every year, and that can stabilize the state.
I want us now, and I guess because this is the next budget we have to think about, we'll go down the throwaway to the city budget. And just this weekend, the mayor announced he was reversing some suggested cuts for the police academy. It sort of continues this trend of him over the course of just a few months announcing cuts, pegs, as we call them, to certain services, certain programs, and then reversing them, which as a journalist is confusing. I don't pretend to be a budget expert, although I try. I don't know if you want to just explain a little bit of that. We have, you know, police academies reversing a lot of these things that were cut to much fanfare. So can you just explain to the very, what do they say on Reddit? Explain it to me like I'm five, of how this is. Were the cuts sort of political moves to try to get more money from the state, or were these real sort of back and forth? Or does this the budget office just not understand how much money the city actually has, if they can then 2 months later take back a cut?
Well, I will say two things about the budget office to start with. First of all, projecting revenues during this time is really hard. And frankly, they were very conservative, and they should have been, but they may well have been overly conservative originally. But it's right to be conservative, but they've probably veered on so much so that they're constraining more the revenue picture than we see. The other thing is they know how much spending is going to be. They're very smart people who track all these things. But frankly, what we're seeing in the budget, the problem is from one perspective, it's not real. You need real numbers on the revenue and spending side to make real hard choices. But these have been illusory. But we'll come back to that in a second. What the mayor did was some rounds of savings plans. But, you know, revenues, like we talked about in the state, they're coming in strong, the financial services. So there's more revenues. Good news. We should be happy for revenues. The administration is always also constraining spending. So there's some underspending and there's money available. So in the short term, there's money in the pocket. So the mayor has decided to reverse some of his savings plans. He's decided to add more spending because the federal money is going away. And we've said you have to put that in the budget to get real. So he's done a little bit of that. Good stuff. But we shouldn't let the short-term money that we have, spending on reversing some cuts and adding some programs, fool us into thinking that we don't have a real fiscal problem in the long run. The city has budget gaps on reasonable estimates, and I'm talking the city controller, the state controller, us, that in the future are about $8 billion. Now, that's pretty big, but that does not include the state class size reduction mandate, which is going to cost $1.5 billion or so dollars. So let's add that. That doesn't include the expansion of the city housing voucher program. So let's add some money for that. That doesn't include the fact that migrants, shockingly, that the cost of serving migrants might actually be continuing in the future. When you add all those up, you see that $8 billion without it, it could be 12, it could be up to $17 billion. That is huge. So what we have to do is get real in the budget. We and the state controllers have said the budget's undercounting spending by $3 to $4 billion. Add that. Get real about the revenues. And now let's look at the fiscal picture and make those hard choices between the city council and the mayor. Again, a little bit like the state, but the city has to make those choices. And right now, with the money burning a hole in its pocket, there's a chance that we make the future worse instead of better.
Hey, Andrew, I do my best every year to follow the budget as closely as I can as it's getting negotiated. And as you're saying, there's no papers or hard numbers to judge at that point. It's all rumor mill stuff, and we're about to have this sort of deal. There are all these non-budgetary components of the budget or things that sort of obscurely relate, like we're going to make a big press to deal with shoplifting, for instance, or give new enforcement authorities when it comes to weed shops that get mushed into this. It used to be three men in a room. Now it's at least two women and a man. It used to be on time. Now it's late. The numbers are so staggering, and it's so much of the business of government that's all getting done at once and as a big mush that it becomes very hard to process. And you're talking about $8 billion holes, but in quarter-trillion-dollar budgets. And I'm hoping you can step back and offer a little perspective on this process, what's functional there and what's not, and significantly, why we're talking about it now. Because as best I can tell, like, the cake is in the oven. They had all this time to talk. We have a deal, and we're talking about what these folks ought to do and need to be doing long-term. But it seems like it's so much and so confusing that the political pressures and the accountability at any short-term moment, it's like, let's get politically useful stuff done. Let's announce victory. Let's spend a little more, and then let's move on. And then we just repeat and repeat and repeat. So I'd love your thoughts on all that, because I struggle with this year after year.
You know, Harry, it's a good point. We have to step back, understand the process, put some contours around it so we can fix it. And there are structural issues and cultural issues. Now, years ago, the CBC looked at different states and different ways they adopted their budgets. And in fact, although there are lots of improvements that are necessary, we're not actually structurally that bad. It's just we are culturally worse and worse over time. And one of the pieces is adding more and more policy to the budget so that there is a culture. And it's not unreasonable that the more you add, the more you realize the budget is your leverage point. That's logical. And the governor was actually quite straight ahead in an interview last week about it. She said, this is the time I can get this done. But that isn't how it always was. And it's not how it is in a lot of places. There are a lot of places that deal with the fiscal contours of the budget. There's a spending plan, and you deal with that. Now, not that there isn't policy that influences, but what we've done here over time, what the Albany leaders have done is say, I want more in here because this is the time I can get what I want. And that's true. But imagine you have 50 different decisions in the pocket. So anything can be traded off with anything at any time. That is not the prescription, has not been the prescription either for good budgeting or probably for good policy. Now, what I will tell you, it gives everyone some compromise where everyone's a winner. Everyone's a winner. I mean, it's an amazing thing because compromise, and that's what politics is. That's Albany, but that's general. But it does serve that well, so everyone can leave that room or the concentric circle or the hallway that they were standing outside and say how we got part of a housing deal, how we got the state to increase the debt cap that New York City can issue, how the unions that won on class size, on healthcare cuts, on construction trades with the housing deal, how everyone can say they win. But at the end of the day, the focus then becomes on those policy issues. The fiscal issues go away for the time being. When they rear its ugly head, everyone's surprised. So I don't think that this culture that has added more and more policy has served either the fiscal situation in the state or the policy issues well, because they don't get what they deserve. They don't get the time. I mean, think about, you know, there always used to be, and, you know, Harry, you and I are old. We've been watching this for a long time. I talked to your father about this years ago. You know, it's like, this is a long time. And there used to be the 1159 deal, but there were budget deals. Now they're every deals. And it's like all the deals. And now the legislature can go home, come back May 6th, adjourn quickly for an election. I mean, I would love it if I had the schedule. But the reality is there are really important issues. Mayoral control is a really important issue. You know, the debate even about the Tier 6 pensions, oh, it's a problem for recruitment. That was just declared. I mean, there's the housing issues. There's some progress made, really important, but it won't do everything we need. We're not there yet. Maybe this was the only way we could get at least some progress, but we really have important issues for the people of New York State that get a short shrift based on how we do this.
So two more questions for you here. First, on one of those issues, and then I do want to talk about the city budget in the time we have for a minute. So this class size deal, just to recap very quickly, and you'll correct me if I get any of this wrong, like Albany passed a new law previously saying class sizes have to be smaller. The teachers union really likes that because it means you're hiring more teachers. And this is happening as the school system in New York City and in lots of places in the state has been shrinking. migrants have now temporarily suspended some of that in the city, but that's been the long-term trend, and that preceded the pandemic. So there's this feeling I keep hearing that like mayoral control is getting on like shorter and shorter time frames, and is sort of getting held hostage to this stuff. And now in exchange for two more years of it, which gets Adams through his reelection bid, right? He has to implement this thing, which presumably he would have had to anyways, but he has a lot of executive control and it wasn't clear he was going to. He was obviously openly unhappy about it. You have this strange dynamic where we have mayoral control. The mayor is really in charge, but it seems to me that John Liu, who ran for mayor himself once, has sort of increasingly and on behalf of the various groups, including the teachers unions who are skeptical, like eroded that with who gets appointments to this council that advises on policy decisions significantly, on all this other stuff. And it seems like a very weird push and pull in which maybe nobody's entirely in charge. And again, this is getting decided through the budget process. So I'm hoping just to get your thoughts on that before we shift just to the city.
I mean, this is a very important issue, both fiscally and for the kids' education. What we saw in this session is, in effect, the teachers' union holding mayoral control hostage so that they could get a more solid commitment to implement the law in such a way that it, by estimates, will require the hiring of 9,000 to 11,000 new members for the teachers' union. That's kind of an amazing thing when, you know, the New York people, residents of New York City, vote for the mayor and are going to hold the mayor accountable in some way, shape, or form for the schools, no matter what. Mayoral accountability and control makes a lot of sense. So that should be done on the merits. And to the extent Albany says to New York City, and frankly to all the other localities, we spend a lot of money. You know, we spent $35 billion in state education aid, but there's not much to promote the exchange of the best practices to hold districts accountable for how they spend the money and making sure kids learn. That all makes sense, but that isn't the discussion. It's about, you know, class size versus mayoral control. You know, when the state doled out $11 billion of federal COVID education aid, it doled it out. It didn't say, how are we going to reverse learning loss and accelerate achievement? It just said, here you go. And frankly, you know, if the state wants to do something, it shouldn't pick a certain managerial strategy like class size reduction over accountability, such as how are the kids doing, to mandate from on high. So the state mandated that there's this class size reduction law. In fact, the city's plans has to be signed off by the teachers union, which is in law. I find a little shocking. So there's this mandate. Now, the New York City has already reduced classes where the evidence is best that it has an effect. Early grades, high need students. That's where the evidence is best. There's evidence that's mixed all over, but that's where it's best. And the city's already in compliance with that place. But now what this law is going to require the city to do is reduce it over 5 years in all the classes. There are some safety valves that the city and the teachers union, if they agree, can apply to the state for waivers. Frankly, the way to go is to actually increase those safety valves, because what has to happen is we have to shrink the popular, well-performing schools. So there's the elementary, middle schools, there's Bronx Science, Brooklyn Tech, and Stuyvesant. We need to shrink the incoming classes if we can't make the buildings larger and hire more teachers there. We're going to shrink the popular, high-performing schools to comply with the law. And then we're also potentially going to have to shrink other programs because we have to hire more teachers. And I'll just leave it with the other thing is we don't have enough space. So we're going to have to build, you know, a lot of classrooms or expand or reconfigure stuff. And that's literally tens of billions of dollars of capital we're talking about. And the city's not willing, and I understand why, to use some administrative remedies. You can move kids because there's space. There's enough high school seats to do it today. It's just not where the kids want to go. So we're going to have to shift resources. It really is the wrong way to go. And tying together class size reduction with mayoral control and accountability is not the right way to go, because the mayor should be able to do it. And if Albany wants to hold him accountable for results, that makes sense. And it should go statewide. There should be a system that matters. That serves the kids.
So with all that, let's turn for just a moment to the city budget, which is itself It's not a quarter of a trillion dollars of total spending. That's not all state spending, by the way, in the state budget. And that's one of the other confusions is you have all these different pools of money that mix together. The city budget, as Katie was saying, there were all of these scheduled cuts, these pegs, a bunch of them are getting undone. There's been a big fight between the council and the mayor about how much revenue there is. The mayor is seeing this much more rightly as we're getting into the season. Some of this seems like it's ritualistic. It happens all the time with proposed cuts and those cuts then being saved and so forth. Real concerns about library service that have come up repeatedly. But all this, again, it's very hard for people to put their heads around and track the whole thing until they see how this actually impacts their library, their school, their trash collection, whatever. I'm hoping you can just offer some perspective on what's actually at stake here and the role that migrants spending and support for that from the state plays in that negotiation and what New Yorkers should be keeping an eye on as this proceeds.
So, yeah. Listen, I think you're exactly right. It's hard to follow all this stuff, from the sides, and everyone's got their own opinions, and some of it's ritualistic, but it's gotten to a point where the numbers aren't real enough in the budget for us to actually pinpoint what's going on, and that is far beyond the pale. So, you know, we put out this report, I think it was called, Real Spending, Real Choices, get real numbers, real budgets, real choices. The reality is my staff overruled. I wanted to call it Don't Fudge It in the Budget. The numbers have to be real. The revenues should be appropriately conservative. Listen, the council thinks there's $3 billion more. If you budget on the most optimistic revenues, you're really good until the economy turns down, and then you are really going to screw people. You have got to be appropriately conservative. The question is, has OMB been so conservative that it veers into, more than is necessary, and so that we think that we've got a bigger budget problem than there is? On the spending side, though, cities always under-budgeted police overtime and all that kind of stuff, and this has always been, part of the game. It's also budgeted one year at a time for, like, libraries and culturals in the old day, what used to be called the budget dance in the old days. It's always done that, but it's gotten to an extreme situation. For example, the council overrode the mayor's veto on expanding city housing vouchers, the FEPS vouchers. Let's put that aside. The current voucher program without the expansion is going to cost, it's estimated, $840 million this year. The budget next year is $170 million. That's not real. That's not a real number. The reality is we know that the city's going to fund those housing vouchers because it's not going to tell those landlords and those residents that they're kicked out, because that would destroy both those people's lives, the landlords' balance sheets, and the credibility of vouchers to come. So that's going to happen, but the budget's not real. The delta is so big. It's probably twice as much as it used to be in terms of that under-budgeting. So under-budgeting has gotten to be like the sport that's going to damage the future. Now, the mayor corrected a little the other day. He corrected a little in January. He's got to correct the other 70% so we can get real with these numbers. And that's where we have to have that discussion. And you have to look at what works. Every mayor has his or her priorities, and that's fine. But we don't layer everything on top of the last. We've got to decide what works for people, what should be shrunk. And that's the choices that's not being made. The council, in fact, put in $3 billion into its spending plan because it said there was underbudgeting. So kudos to the council. I think that they're adding $1.6 billion is unaffordable in the long run. As I said, we in the controllers see $8 billion gaps that could expand to $17 billion, in the future with all these mandates and the program expansions. So we have to be smart this time and realize the money we have has to be spent wisely in the long run. And that's about hard choices and be willing to lead, which says yes, but also says no.
Last real quick thing, and then Katie's jumping back in, but I realize we didn't do this up front. Who are you? What is the CBC?
I just figured if you're listening to the FAQ,
Yeah, everyone sort of knows.
Sorry.
And people attend to cocktail parties and stuff like that, but this stuff's confusing. So I figured just having that straight out is helpful.
Wait, you guys have cocktail parties? I'm just kidding. I've never been to one. So go ahead. Sorry.
We do have happy hour occasionally over here and have food. And that's a little break from the relief. Although budgets are fun. A lot of people don't realize what kind of fun you can have. I'm just telling you, we got budget jokes. We got it all. Citizens Budget Commission is a 92-year-old nonpartisan nonprofit watchdog, making sure city and state government is doing the right thing, and also think tank, doing the real deep research and making practical recommendations on how to run things better. And we cover, you know, budgets and labor, but we also do energy, environment, housing, economic development, transportation, infrastructure, a lot of work on the MTA. And we're governed by and supported by 150 trustees that are civic and business and nonprofit leaders in the city. And they're actually very involved with the research, which makes us both smarter because they know stuff and more practical because people who've actually done stuff for a living say, they can look at our staff recommendations and say, that doesn't work. So it makes us practical, more grounded, and it's an incredible model that has worked for a long time. And hopefully we both suggest and promote the ideas that work. And sometimes some of the successes is stopping the bad things from happening.
Well, you mentioned budgets are fun, but I don't know what you had more fun doing. Talking about budgets for how, I don't know how long you've been to the CBC, for a long time, as you said earlier, or playing in what is described as a ska, reggae, funk, Afro-pop mashup band, Plato Shrimp, from 1984-1989. I love to find out things about people, not that it's unexpected, but, you know, you interact with so many people as a reporter and you know them for, this person is the expert on budgets, this person is the expert on housing, but we all have rich lives beyond that. So if you want to talk a little bit about your band, would you ever reunite? What that was like long before your budget days, or maybe you were looking at budgets back in 1986 as well. I'm not sure.
When I was 5 years old, living on 21st Avenue and 149th Street in Queens, that's the day when any of us remember Adventures Inn and when White Stone Lanes had candlepin bowling. Because I was five, I couldn't hold a ball. I started my first band on 21st Avenue when I was five with my friends Kevin and Chris. So it was my first love. I saw these guys practicing down the street in those cellar steps. I sat on the cellar steps at night because you were 5 years old. You could sit at night outside because that's what we did down the street. And I came home and I said, I'm growing my hair long, which I don't have any hair now. I'm growing my hair long and I'm going to play rock and roll. So somehow, by hook or by crook, eventually I fell in with these guys, Plato Shrimp. We had a 4 or 5 year career, put out a record, another one in the can. You can get it all on all those music services. And it was a lot of fun to create something. And there's nothing more satisfying. I mean, listen, I think CBC does great work, can affect millions of people's lives over time. My career professionally, whether it be CBC or public health. On the other side, you know, when you play something and someone's sweating and dancing and smiling and wants to pay money to enjoy what you do, that's great stuff. So, you know, we stopped playing. We did have a reunion in 2016, which was kind of amazing. I was bringing my son around to see colleges. I was like, we got to go to Johnny D's. We got to go to the old home club. I walk in, Carla D., who ran the club, took it over from her father. I was friends with, you know, 25 years before. She was sitting there, talked just like her mother at the bar. She's like, hey, who are you? And we talked. She said, I'm closing the club. Can you get the band back together? We got together for a reunion show. We were a little slower. It was a lot harder. You know, my sax player is a pro in New York. He's great. He's like, this will be easy. I was like, for you. But but my kids came, my nephews came, and 300 people came from everywhere, from London to Alaska. Wow. And I recognized some of these people. I was like, you kind of look familiar. Like, we used to come when we were dating and now we're married. And we gave the kids to my parents and we came to the show as our anniversary present.
Wow.
That is just great stuff. And so music is always music, food, policy. There's nothing better than the three of them.
Wait. So getting the band back together, that's Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
I got to ask. You eat a lot of acid, Andrew, back in the hippie days, and I'm quoting there.
I hear you. Plato Shrimp is the movie.
And this is from Repo Man, right? The band name.
So I joined the band 8 months after it started. They got a gig. Donnie and Giorgio started the band in a bathroom because it had good acoustics. Giorgio learned to play guitar, blah, 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 blah. And they had a gig and suddenly they needed a name. They said, what's a stupid name that we can throw away? And the problem is they picked Plate of Shrimp and then the band was good. So they kept the name. And, you know, do I think it wore well with time? Whatever. You know, it is what it is. There was a hardcore band, I think, out of Minneapolis, like 7 or 8 years later, who used that name, which I find a little disturbing. But I find it, in the tradition of Plate of Shrimp, you're thinking about a Plate of Shrimp, you're thinking Plate of Shrimp, you know, maybe it's exactly the right thing to have two bands with that name.
Well, you can listen to Plate of Shrimp on Spotify, which is where I and other reporters sit when I discovered this. I think the band's great. And you play guitar, correct? Am I looking at the photo correctly?
I play guitar.
Wow. And you still play.
I still play, and I record on my iPhone using GarageBand. and I try to play every night before going to sleep to get a little sanity.
Perfect. Well, Andrew Ryan from the Citizens Budget Commission, thank you so much for joining us and talking about budgets and your musical career up in Boston, connecting people and bringing lots of joy to their life, just like a budget does to us now. So thank you for coming on.
Of course.
FAQ.
FAQ NYC receives support from P&T Knitwear, an independent bookstore, cafe, and event space on Manhattan's Lower East Side with a podcast studio that can be freely reserved for community use. The pod's friends include The City, a nonprofit newsroom where journalists, including our Katie Honan and Harry Siegel, deliver hard-hitting news that serves the people of New York. The Colin Powell School at CUNY City College, where Dr. Christina Greer is one of the Moynihan Public Scholars Inaugural Fellows. And Flaming Hydra, a collective of 60 writers, including Harry, delivering a cooperatively owned new newsletter you'll actually want to read. I'm our engineer, Adam Kamara, and Harry is our executive producer. Thank you to our guest, Andrew Ryan from the Citizens Budget Commission. And thank you, listener, for joining us and making it this far. Be kind, be cool, and we'll be back soon with more.